You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
You're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 277, entitled How to Leverage Fear and Struggle into Unbelievable Success, I chat with Akshay Nanavati. Akshay Nanavati is a United States Marine veteran, speaker, entrepreneur, ultra runner, and author of the book Fearvana. In today's episode, Akshay talks about his book Fearvana, the revolutionary science of how to turn fear into health, wealth, and happiness, and he discusses leveraging your greatest struggles into your greatest successes. He breaks down the truth about fear and about negative emotions and why these can both be incredible propellers for growth and happiness in life. Akshay also talks about his ultra marathon runs, pitch black week-long retreats, and pushing himself both physically and mentally in all areas of life. If you're wondering how to turn your biggest struggles into success, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. Listen, guys, here's the God's honest truth. We're living in a chaotic time. You already know this. However, what you may not already know is that we're also living in a censorship time. A lot of good information is being suppressed. A lot of good information is being censored. You can look no further than the podcast episode we dropped several weeks back about the COVID-19 pandemic. That podcast episode was actually taken down in Spotify and a number of other platforms because they didn't like the information that we were talking about. Now, we only cover fair and balanced information on this show and try to give you a good holistic perspective on helping yourself, helping your family, and helping your loved ones. But for some reason, that information just doesn't align with some of the mainstream authorities out there who don't like that type of information. They don't like for you to be in charge of your health. They don't like for you to be in charge of your family's health. And for whatever reason, they try to suppress it. Now, I'm all about being an open book. I'm all about being fair, and I'm all about hearing all sides of a solution to a potential problem. But what I do hate most in life is being censored and having my opinion censored when I know I'm being fair and balanced. And that is one thing that honestly pisses me off, probably more than anything. And so with that information, I want you guys to sign up for the email list if you haven't done that. Make sure you go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter and sign up today, because no matter who censors us, all the information that you need is always going to be delivered through the email. We're always going to get the information, all the podcasts out to you. So if one platform goes down, we're always going to have the main platform at Elite Man Magazine. We're going to have the links to give you the episodes that you need. elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter is the number one place to sign up today, so you don't miss any of our episodes going forward. If they try to pull us down again, I guarantee you we will come back up and we will have those episodes ready for you. You may have even missed that original episode on COVID-19 if you listen to, say, Spotify or another platform that got taken down. But whatever the case, make sure you sign up for the newsletter so you don't miss anything else. Whether that's our YouTube videos, whether that's our podcasts, whether that's articles, whatever else, whatever information that you need will be delivered to you in your email address when you sign up for the Elite Man newsletter. So make sure you sign up for that now. Also, on that same token, you might as well follow us across the board. Subscribe to our channel on YouTube if you haven't done that yet. Follow me on Instagram at Justin Stenstrom if you haven't done that yet. Follow me on Facebook at Justin Stenstrom if you haven't done that yet. And join the Facebook group as well, the Elite Man Mastermind, if you haven't done that yet. Follow us across the board on all things, because one platform may take us down, but another platform is definitely going to have us. And if all the platforms decide to come together one day and ban all of our content, guess what? We're still going to find a way to get you that information that you need. The best way to get that information, though, is to join the newsletter, elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter today. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from Elite Man Magazine, and my guest today is Akshay Nanavati. Is that right, man? How do you say your name?
That's perfect, yeah. Perfect.
It's a little
nicely
done. It's a little tricky. I'm just trying to familiarize myself with it before we jumped on. But, dude, you have an incredible story. Like, you sent me the information. I went through your background, kind of dug into some stuff. It's just an incredible story all around, and you're doing some fascinating work right now. And then the topic we're going to cover today is a topic that I mentioned a moment ago that I guys just love on the show. Like, we cover fear and using it to your advantage. Once you harness the power of fear, you can propel yourself into doing some incredible things in life. And you've done that like time and time again for the past few years. So I want to dive into that. But can you just take like maybe 60 seconds or so, Akshay, and just kind of talk about what it is you do right now?
Yeah, what I do right now is I wrote this book, Fear of Anna. I'm the creator of this concept, Fear of Anna. And the whole idea is leveraging not just fear, but at a higher level, struggle and pain and suffering of any kind as an access point to bliss and enlightenment. So what I currently do, I have the book, I do public speaking, I do these various ultra runs and adventures all around the world. I sell digital information products. And what we're building around the concept of Fear of Anna is this movement in a series of products and services in multiple verticals. So creating like a Fear of Anna Academy, Fear of Anna Fitness, Fear of Anna Festivals, Fear of Anna Retreats, Fear of Anna Journeys. I have my own nonprofit called the Fear of Anna Foundation. So really building a movement to help people develop a positive relationship to suffering so they can do three things: find, live, and love their worthy struggle.
Nice, man. Love it. So let's dive into Fear of Anna in a few moments and kind of tackle that. But Marine Corps veteran, how many years ago was that? And are you still active at all with that? Like, do you still...
Out now. I got out in 2010, did 6 years in and one tour in Iraq in 07 as an infantry non-commissioned officer.
Nice. Cool. Yeah. What made you want to dive into that? Was there something like you always wanted to do that, or was it something that just kind of propelled you in the moment?
I moved to the U.S. at 13. So when I joined the Marines, I wasn't even a U.S. citizen. I moved in from India and Singapore. Born in India, moved to the U.S. at 13. And when I moved to Austin, I got very heavily, soon after moving here, got very heavily into drugs, into alcohol, a very self-destructive lifestyle. I used to cut myself, burn myself. I still have scars on my arm from doing that from way back when. I mean, did a lot of things that could have very easily killed me. And I did, in fact, lose two friends to drug addiction. So heading down that path and watching the movie Black Hawk Down was the trigger that changed my life. You ever seen that movie?
I actually haven't seen the movie, but I interviewed a guy that's based on Satterley. You ever heard of the guy? Tom Satterley. He's what was the special operations forces there that they had in the movie?
It was Rangers and Delta.
He was a Delta guy. That's what it was. He was a Delta guy. I had him on the show like a year or two ago. Really cool dude. Badass, of course.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the whole thing. And I actually meant to like follow up and watch the movie because I know it was a good movie beforehand, but never actually knew about it. But I actually haven't gotten around to it, and I probably should. But heard it's a badass movie.
Yeah, powerful movie. It's a true story, of course. And watching that movie and just watching these men sacrificing their lives for something greater than themselves, for someone greater than themselves. There's one particular scene where these two Medal of Honor recipients, Gary Gordon and Randy Sugar, they're Delta snipers who they were in a chopper in a relatively safe area, but they volunteered to go to the ground, just two men, not knowing when reinforcements were to arrive, to set up a defensive perimeter to protect one of their fellow soldiers, Michael Durant, and thousands of armed enemy heading their way. They knew what they were getting into and volunteered anyway. And they both died, but they died protecting Michael Durant. They received the Medal of Honor posthumously for their valor. And just watching that, man, it just triggered something in me about this selfish and meaningless and worthless existence I was living and realized that, you know, what kind of people would do that. So after watching the movie, I read the book Black Hawk Down and just started delving into book after book after book on military and life in combat, and pretty much overnight decided to stop doing drugs and join the military.
That self-harm and all that stuff, did that come from a specific insecurity in your mind from the past, or did it have to do with some type of issue or trauma that you experienced, or was it just like you were kind of bored and lost in that moment? And of course, drugs and alcohol exacerbate the situation. Was it one of those things, or was it something in the past, you think?
You know, no trauma. I've had great parents. Couldn't have asked for better parents. Loved me. Great. Gave me a great life. I've obviously assessed it now, and my parents have asked me what they could have done differently. Truth be told is, you know, like I said, great parents. But when we moved around, so I moved to four cities by the age of 13. So I was, when I moved to Austin, I was very lost. I was kind of trying to figure out. I was not one of those kids who knew at like seven, I'm going to do X or, you know, whatever. No idea what I wanted to do. And as a result of moving, I became very adaptable. So every place I moved, and this is, this is, this can be a very positive quality, but if you're not careful and if you're, you know, it can become negative, which it did. So I was very adaptable. Every place I moved, made a lot of friends, built, you know, just did well. But when I moved to Austin, and again, I don't blame anybody else. I take responsibility for my behavior. But as a young kid, you're impressionable, you're moldable, right? So I got into a group of friends that, you know, we started delving down, and I always have been this kind of person that anything I do, I'm going to take to the extreme. So now I do it in positive ways with running ultras and stuff like that. But when we got into that, I was, me and one other guy were the first in our group to start going from alcohol and marijuana into harder stuff. And he is actually no longer alive today. He ended up ODing and dying. And like I said, me and him was started. I was at a point, man, I would have done anything. So it was just kind of not knowing who I was, just lost. And then that became the avenue to prove my worth, to show how extreme I am, to be the badass, right? Like, I'm the dude who does all this crazy shit, cutting my, and it just was obviously a very unhealthy avenue to do it. But that's what I kind of became, you know, and like no sense of direction, clearly.
Yeah. So that's incredible, man. And I can still relate to a lot of that stuff too, to be honest. And there was a time in my life, and I mentioned this in the book I had recently called Leap Mine. I wrote it in late January, but it was a period in my life where it was a lot of the stuff that you're talking about, a lot of struggles, insecurities, and not really knowing what you want to do with yourself. And
yeah,
just basically lost and trying to figure yourself out. But I was doing boxing for a couple of years and like went really into it. Like in my mind, I was going to be a professional boxer. And I was fighting all the time, sparring all the time, having matches, like amateur matches all the time. But long story short, it just wasn't for me. It wasn't my path. Like I wasn't one of these guys who's built to, you know, fucking get hit in the face all the time and take all these blows. So I just kept pushing myself. And that was like my way of sort of like self-harm and like pushing myself past what was healthy for myself and doing the right things. And I just got really lost into that. And then after that was like really depressed and anxious all the time and had all these problems. But it's like, I can so see why you fell into that and why I fell in. Like a lot of people fall into those types of behaviors because you just don't know what to do with yourself and you're trying to figure yourself out. And especially as a man, you want to be like tough and you want to be masculine. You want to prove yourself. But it's like a lot of that stuff is like we have this energy inside of us, but we put it towards the wrong thing and it can be very self-destructive. Yeah. Whereas if we channel that into something else like you've done, I think I've done the last few years, you know, we can do a lot of good.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why I call it like your worthy struggle. When you find that path, it's like it will be hard, you know, like and I mean, there's nothing wrong with having passion for your craft. But often when we say things like follow your passion, it conveys this idea that it will be easy or sunshine and unicorns. And people always say, you know, if you love what you do, it'll never feel like a day of work in your life. I think that's like garbage. You know, I love what I do. There's days it's fucking work, man. It's hard. You know, it's really hard. And I call your path your worthy struggle. Like there will be pain. There will be struggle, but you know that pain has virtue. There's purpose to it. Like back then, the things I was doing had no, there was no virtue to that pain. Now, I mean, running, like just last weekend, man, I ran 50 miles around a cul-de-sac. That was psychologically and physically painful and spiritual, like pain in every way, you know, but there was virtue to that pain. I had earned that pain. There was beauty to that pain, you know? So I get what you mean. And I think we got to find our worthy struggle to find that path and find the pain that has purpose.
Yeah, no shit, man. So 50 miles, how long did it take you to do that?
I'm not really sure, to be honest with you. I started off sometime in the middle, and I was just kind of a blur because I did it around a cul-de-sac. So I was, I started at night to be into – I really wanted to make it as psychologically miserable as possible. So going around a cul-de-sac, you got nighttime, so it's like the darkness. There's no race energy. There's no one cheering you on. You got the darkness, so it's just you and your damn mind going where it's going to go, and you got to fight that. So I'm not exactly sure. I ended it sometime in the morning, and I can't even remember what time it started. It was just all a little bit of a blur by the end of it. I mean, because I was just doing it myself, you know, so I was just wasn't really tracking or anything like that. It was just – I just knew I hit 50 miles.
Yeah, wow. So yeah. You're a sick man. That's awesome.
Very much so, man. That's one example of many, many out there things that I do.
Yeah. So what are some of the other like ultra races that you've done? It says somewhere that you did like 167 miles or something like that. And what are some of these other ones that you've done too to push yourself?
I've done 80 miles around a 0.2 mile loop. That was, again, psychological torture.
Wow.
I've done a bunch of other ultras. I've never done an official – well, actually, I've done one race, which was a 50K. But I've done a bunch of other ultras on my own where I've done a bunch of other 50Ks, a couple of 50-milers, 100K, the 80-miler. And then in Liberia, what I did was I ran 167 miles across the entire country. It was about just under a marathon a day for a week to help raise funds to build the first sustainable school in post-war Liberia. So we were raising funds to build a school. We were stopping – that's why I did about a marathon a day, so we had time at the end of the day to do things like distributing water filters, school supplies to villages. So it was like a humanitarian trip combined with this run. It was profound, intense. Obviously running a marathon a day was challenging to say the least. And then you're in a brand new post-war country, which had its own set of unique experiences, and being this pretty strange dude out there. I mean, I look a little different than everybody in Liberia. So you get stared at a lot, not to mention who the hell else is running in the middle of when people are in a village without food and water, nobody's out running like a jackass, So you get stared at a lot, but it was a hell of an experience, man. Very profound experience.
So how does your body manage all this? Like, is it tough on your knees, tough on your ankles, tough on your joints, like doing all this work and like physically, how are you managing that?
Totally. So I'm actually physically not designed to be a runner. I have flat feet. I have scoliosis. Yeah, I have a blood disorder that two doctors told me would kill me in boot camp. Like, so I had to fight my way into the Marines. It took me a year and a half to get all these medical waivers to go into the Marines. And only reason I think I got in, because it was post 9/11. So you're a young dumb kid ready to go in. So they were like, yeah, we'll send you in. I don't think I would have got in a non-wartime environment. But anyway, so I had this blood disorder, but basically transports less oxygen through my body. Not a good sign for anybody, let alone an athlete, right? So I got that, the scoliosis, the flat feet, and I have another condition where the villi in my esophagus are worn out, so I can't absorb nutrition too well. So I'm not designed, far from designed to being a runner. Yeah. So I've gotten, you name the running injury, I've gotten it all, right? Like I've ruptured my Achilles tendon, IT band, this, that, and the other thing. And so what I did was upping my recovery game. For a long time, I didn't used to spend a lot of time on recovery. I would be pretty good at the training, but not so good at the recovery. So now I devote more time to recovery. I'm really blessed to be sponsored by Hammer Nutrition. Their nutrition, I'm not just saying this because I'm sponsored. Like they were my dream sponsor. They're like they're the best nutrition and supplement company for endurance athletes. So I'm really blessed to partner with them. And their stuff has transformed me, man. Like injury-free. Since I've gotten partnered with them, only reason I'm not running more than I already do is because I got like other stuff to do other than just running all the time.
Forrest Gump.
So upping the recovery game, up like doing the right nutrition, the right supplements, they've really helped kind of stay injury free since then.
Nice. So what was in your mind, what was the hardest race or run that you've done? What was the toughest challenge physically and also mentally?
You know, the one that stands out in my mind when I did the 72 miler. So it wasn't my longest run and it was not like around a cul-de-sac, but you just never know when low moments are going to hit. Right. So I've done like harder ones objectively, like in the sense I did 80 miles around a 0.2 mile loop, which objectively that appears harder. But when I did the 72 mile run, I just remember mile 48 hitting this soul crushing low. And I still remember it to this day, like just sitting there, and it was 48 miles to the T, I remember, and just sat there being like, I did not want to move another step. I was in super victim mode. I was like ready to call an Uber and be just like bitching, complaining, life sucks, everything hurting, I don't want to be here, and just feeling this like weight on my soul, and that was a hard moment. And then I just finally, after being a victim for a minute or so, I was like, all right, just take a step. Let's just take a few steps and we'll figure it out from there. And then kind of got back into the groove. But I remember that one was pretty tough. There were some moments in Liberia that were not as physically intense, but I would say spiritually intense. And what I mean by that was it was actually day one of Liberia. I think it was day one. Yeah. I was running. And the cool thing about running and what happened there is a lot of times these kids would start running with me. Because again, I'm a strange sight. So they'd come running and we would start chatting or whatever. And these two kids started running with me. And one of them, Blessing and Emmanuel, were the names. And one of them wanted to go to med school. The other one wanted to go to vocational training school. And the odds of that happening were damn near zero, and they lived in this little village. One of the kids had lost his father in the war because Liberia went through a brutal civil war, and lost his mother, I think, had left and like something like that, and he was living with the other kid in this tiny village. And I just remember after chatting with them for a little bit, they went we passed their hut, like their village area. They went to their hut and whatever. And I was just running and thinking, what did I do to deserve the life I've gotten? The only difference in me and that kid really is we were born to different mothers in different worlds. Like the luck of the draw that I was born where I was born to good family in India, and he was born where he was born to in a war zone. And it was just really, and I've had many moments like that, from working with victims of sex trafficking to teaching child soldiers to being in leper colonies, where you just like, it just hits you. But you add the run into the stress of the run in combination with that was really, and then there was many moments like that on the run where you're just looking at people in poverty, people who have lost, like again, working with former child soldiers when I was in Liberia. And it just, it's intense, man. It hits you hard, you know, and you just want, like, I've questioned for a long time, why do I get this life? Why do I deserve it? I mean, I struggled after the war, struggled with survivor's guilt because I lost a friend in the war, you know, and I struggled with a lot of this stuff. So that's kind of what inspired me to go on some deeper healing paths very recently. Before Liberia, I spent 7 days in a darkness retreat to go just deep within, to really, like, pitch darkness, 7 days of pitch darkness, isolation and silence, to go within, to confront some of these existential questions about why am I here and why do I get these good things?
Yeah, I was actually literally just going to ask you about that. What, were you on DMT when you did that and that experience of 7 days? And what did you get out of that whole experience? Like, that just sounds intense and scary and, like, everything imaginable. What did you get out of, like, from being after the 7 days were up?
You know, I wasn't on DMT, but what happens is they say your brain starts to naturally release DMT because when you're in intense darkness, I mean, literally no light, not even this much light for 1 second in the entire 7 days. So you have psychedelic trips, and I had tons of psychedelic trips. I mean, from day probably like one and a half, I was seeing purple lights, and I don't know why these lights were these colors or whatever, but like until about day two, I was seeing purple lights, kind of like a lava lamp. And then for some reason, the light purple disappeared. And then all I saw was red and some green here and there, except for one day on like day five, I saw this blinding white light, like blindingly bright white light. I mean, I was literally touching my eyelids because I couldn't tell if my eyes were closed or open anymore. So I was touching my eyelids, couldn't tell, like, are they closed or open? I was, like, trying to cover my eyes to see it. Like, I felt like I needed an eye mask to sleep because it was so bright, the light. I mean, so I had very psychedelic trips like that. But, yeah, it was profound, man. But I was also journaling a lot in the dark. So journaling and, like, processing a lot of this stuff. And what came up for me was this feeling that I, like, because I really worked through some of that stuff about, like, the questions about why do I get this life that I've gotten, and processing a lot more of these feelings, and really, like, paradoxically, what came to me in the dark was at a high level more feeling of light, feeling of joy, feeling of permission to be okay. Like that, like, me being happy is not going to change the fact that there are suffering in the world. If anything, happiness becomes like service fuel. It becomes a tool to transcend myself, to help others, you know? So permission to feel lighter. So a lot of that stuff came through, but by far, like, the most profound part of the darkness retreat was when I came back into the light after 7 days. When I came back into the light and the first time I took off the mask, I can't even describe what the world looked like in that moment. Like, there's two thoughts that ran through my mind. One was, I wish I could look at the world every day through these eyes that I'm seeing it right now. And the second was this deep sense of, like, this deep sense of gratitude in a very visceral way, of that gratitude for every bit of pain and suffering that I've ever felt in my life. Because in a very tangible and visceral way, I got to see that you cannot really see the light this way. You cannot understand the light this way unless you've been in the dark. You know, and obviously what I mean that is literally, but as well as figuratively, in the sense that literally I got to see the light in the world differently after being in the dark for 7 days. And there was this knowing. I mean, one can say it, you can kind of cognitively understand it, but there was a knowing of that. And that was, I mean, beyond profound, man.
Yeah, that's incredible, man. That is fucking unbelievable. I never heard of anybody else doing that anyways.
Yeah, I didn't know that thing existed. I was actually going to go into those silent retreats, like a Vipassana, which are much more famous, like 10-day silent retreats. But as I mentioned, I'm the kind of guy who will always do the most extreme path. So when I was researching silent retreats, I stumbled into the concept of a darkness retreat, and I was like, done. Let's go to forget the silence. Let's go into darkness, silence, and isolation as well.
Oh, shit. So two questions with the 7-day retreat. Did you have any food and water during that time? And did you also, like, when you're journaling, writing down and stuff, do you have any bit of light where you can see where you're writing? Or is it just journaling to put something down so you can look at it later, basically?
Yeah. So first question, I did have smoothies. So you can choose three options: water, smoothies, or food. I chose the middle ground because I wanted to experience extra pangs of hunger, but I don't have a lot of weight to lose, and I needed to come out and get right back into my running. Yeah. So I was like, let's do the middle ground of smoothies. So I did do that. The way it works is, like, the place I did it, three times a day they'll bring a smoothie and they ring a little bell. So when the bell rings, they put a smoothie in the hallway, and then whenever you want, you go grab it. But the hallway is pitch dark as well. Okay. So you just kind of go grab it on the counter and, you know. Yeah. And you kind of know, you just, you know, grab the smoothie, drink it. And it's like heaven. It's like literally Pavlov's dogs, man. The bell rings and you're like salivating. You're like, yes, smoothie, you know? So that was, yeah. So I did have that. And as far as the journaling, no light at all. So I kind of just had like a ruler, and I would, you know, write and then move the ruler around. So obviously it wasn't in the lines, but you know, I would put like another book, right on that line, move the line, move the book down.
Right. Yeah.
and then kind of like dog ear the page when I was done. Only one time I did write over myself, and I still remember that moment in the darkness. I was like, I think I'm on that page. So I just like skipped two pages, and I was like, I didn't want anything after that to be, you know, written over myself. But I mean, I'm glad I did, because it was very profound, the stuff that showed up. And what I mean by showed up is like my book, Fearvana, I feel like I wrote that. In the darkness journal, it was like just stuff kind of coming through. You know what I mean? It was less cognitive and more just stream of consciousness. So eventually, though, my plan is I'm going to go spend like, I don't know, like a month or something in the darkness and just go write a whole book in there.
That's insane, eventually. Dude. So when you look back at your journaling notes, what were some of the things that you were writing during that time? Was there anything like crazy, profound that stuck out?
A lot, man. I got actually have my darkness journal right here. I reread it often. I have my darkness journal. Yeah, a lot of stuff coming up on these very deep existential questions on like the nature of God, what is the meaning of life, the essence of why we are here. And, you know, and I'm not saying my answers are quote unquote right, because I don't think there's inherent right answers of these kind of questions. But they were answers that really satisfied me. I mean, I still remember reading the journal on my flight back from Germany, because I did this in Germany, and I was like tearing up reading it, being like, oh, that is profound. And not in some sort of egotistical way that I wrote it, just in the sense that like almost reading what wasn't mine, you know what I mean? Like just these words that were deeply profound. So I got a lot just on these very deep existential. And sometimes, like, I mean, really the experience was like a moment of deep journaling and then meditation. So sometimes just silent meditation of just, you know, silencing the mind. And then the other kind of meditation of letting the thoughts go where they go. And then sometimes just sitting there in the dark being like, fuck, I got a long time left in the dark. So it was kind of a combination of, you know, this wave of those kind of feelings. But like stuff that came through was really cool, man. Really profound from the journal.
That's awesome.
About what
life is. Do you lose track of time? It seems like you would, but I'm just thinking in my head, like the only way that I would know what time it is, what day it is when they come in with the smoothies and they ring the bell and stuff, right? Like you can kind of keep track that way.
So they don't bring the smoothies at the same time every day intentionally. So you kind of are, so you don't get oriented to time. Yeah. So you don't have a sense of hours, but you do have a sense of days, because the room is not soundproof. So outside every morning you would hear the birds chirping, and it was like a significantly more amount of birds chirping. So I had a sense of when it was morning, but you have no sense of hours other than that.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. So as far as the Fearvana book, the concept that you've come out with the last few years too, the Dalai Lama wrote something about that. What did he have to say, and how did you get in touch with this guy? You know, of all people, one of the most enlightened human beings that's probably ever existed. How did you get in contact with him?
It was just a pure cold pitch, you know, like when I decided to write this book. Fearvana is a deeply spiritual concept, right? These two seemingly contradictory ideas, fear and nirvana, that ultimately uniting them in a complementary way to access a greater spiritual awakening. That's the whole essence of the book. The third chapter of the book is called Awakening. The first section is awareness and acceptance. The second section is action. The third is awakening. So it's all about, you know, taking exercising awareness to take action and then attain a new awakening. So very spiritual concept. So in my mind, I was like, who's the spiritual leader of the world in many ways? Dalai Lama. So I remember when I first thought that, I was like, there's no way, like, who am I? I was unknown, dude. Like, I didn't have a platform, nobody, right? Like, I had nothing. I just come out of a pretty dark world. I mean, after the war, I'd come back from, you know, struggle with depression, alcoholism. I was on the verge of suicide, you know? So just coming out of all this darkness and kind of no platform. So I kind of shut off that thought. And then later on, I remember thinking, okay, what's the worst that could happen? Let me just try. Like, in worst case, I just get a no and I'm exactly where I'm at. So I did a cold pitch. I did like a ton of research, found one name, one email in the office of the Dalai Lama. I shot a personal video for him, sharing my personal story, the struggles I've been through, what we're trying to do. All the profits from the book are going to charity, the essence of what Fearvana is about, how we want to help people navigate the suffering in the human experience. And this monk connected me to three other monks and like finally connected to one person. And 5 months of building a relationship with that monk, I finally got, and I only asked for a one-line endorsement, but I was really blessed that he wrote the foreword. But the biggest lesson from that I really want to share is in that 5 months of reaching out to the monk, the whole time I write to them and then, you know, don't get an email back. My whole time of mind, I'm like, they probably hate me. They probably hate my book. They're ignoring me. All that self-doubt, that lack of self-worth, that fear, that anxiety, this, that, and the other thing, right? But what I've really learned, and one of the core concepts of Fearvana, is that we can have all these emotions, the fear, the stress, the anxiety, the doubt, whatever, but we don't have to be defined by these emotions. they're not negative. It's a normal human response. Like, I don't like the way when people phrase negative and bad emotions and good emotions. There are no bad and good emotions. There's just emotions. And some are more challenging than others, but they're not bad. So I learned to be with my emotions, but not be defined by my emotions. So I would follow up anyway. And had I not done that, I mean, 5 to 6 months of this, and had I not done that, you know, I wouldn't, I mean, obviously on a personal and spiritual level, it's a huge blessing for me to get an endorsement from the Dalai Lama for my work, but also just in terms of marketing the book, obviously game changer for an unknown author. To have the Dalai Lama write a foreword, you know, changed everything. But that required me transcending my own stuff, my own fears, to keep fighting, fighting for the mission, fighting for something bigger than me.
Yeah, that's incredible, man. Good for you. And man, look at the persistence there and everything, just like determination to keep following up and going through it. And you're right. Like, I think so many people, and I've done this many times in the past myself, is like, we aim too low because we think we're not good enough or on the same level. Exactly. You know, capable of achieving something like that, like having the Dalai Lama write a foreword for your book. Most first-time authors would never even consider that because they would think that they're just not on that level. Like, if you're Tony Robbins, yeah, you can probably pull off Dalai Lama. But if you're you or me, it's just like, you know, you wouldn't even think. But, you know, to have that belief in yourself to keep pushing through, man, it's really impressive. And, you know, also, as far as the emotions, like, not defining us, that is a really a key concept that I've been teaching and talking about lately, too, is
– yeah.
You know, you get these emotions throughout the day, and whether it's good or bad, whatever you want to define them as, like, you, even defining them is probably an issue, but you have these things popping up throughout the day, and you just, you can either, like, resist them, try to fight them off, and then usually when you do that, it persists, it gets worse.
Exactly.
Or you can just sort of accept them and observe them from, like, an outside point of view and just become an observer of them. And then when you become an observer, you step back away from being in the midst of it all, and then at that point, you're able to then transfer that into, like, the positive emotions that you want to have, the good feelings and emotions that you want to have, not because you're stepping away from being defined immediately as, like, a reflex that we all have of when something pops up. Like, those emotions aren't necessarily good or bad. They just how you want to act at that point in time, and then you can go forward, like, in the way that you want to go forward in.
Absolutely. Exactly. You know, you got to, like, notice the, so one of my mantras is be with what is, but do not become what is. When I was running one day, I had this, like, one of my usual runs, you experience a lot of pain. So the mantra came to me, be with the pain, but do not become the pain. And I think the same thing applies to the emotion, you know, be with the fear, but do not become the fear, but not be defined by the fear. So what I do is, like, one, I mean, I talk a lot about the neuroscience of how this all works in the book, but, like, what neuroscience has shown, that we're not, we don't control most of what happens in our brain anyway. So right now, if I'm sitting in this room and somebody shows up with a gun, I'm not choosing to feel fear. My brain's going to register fear because it says this thing could kill me. I'm not choosing it. And that's not, like, so most of the time our emotional response to a stimuli is outside our control. So to your point, it's about noticing the emotion and often just labeling the emotion. Neuroscience has also shown that when you label an emotion, it reduces activity in the emotional parts of our brain and increases activity in the part of our brain related to focus and awareness. So I could say something like, I'm feeling fear. Obviously, I wouldn't do that if a guy came with a gun. That's, you'd handle it. But I mean, his point in regular non-threatening situations, you pause. I'm feeling fear, I'm feeling stress, I'm feeling anxiety. And I did this, dude, writing a book on fear, I was terrified. I was terrified that somebody would think it's garbage, people wouldn't like it, and what if nobody ever reads it? So much work's gone into it. But because I was scared, I engaged the fear. So I wrote down, what am I scared of? Why am I scared? What's the worst case scenario? How do I prepare for the worst case scenario? And by engaging the fear, by studying the fear, by transcending the fear, and this is to your point, not resisting it, but by understanding it, digging deeper into it, I ended up realizing that, okay, if I'm scared of writing a bad book at a very simple level, if I'm scared of writing a bad book, let me study, how do I write a good book? So I studied from mentors, like authors like Jack Canfield, the Chicken Soup for the Soul series guy. And I studied from him, how do you write a better book? And I must have trashed, like, dude, over 100,000 words worth of work. But as a result, I wrote a book now worthy of being endorsed by the Dalai Lama, and a book I'm truly proud of. Yes, it was a lot of freaking work. That's months worth of work. But my fear drove me to writing a better book. If I wasn't scared, I would have just put something out there, you know? So having fear for anything is not a bad thing. It's what we do with it. And we can make it work. And the most everything I do worthwhile has been terrifying, from joining the Marines to going to war to building a business to writing a book to running. All these things terrify me, man. And that's what makes it worthwhile.
Yeah, it's funny, too, when you hear, like, some – not – I mean – I don't even know how to put this, but some people still, I think, have the idea, even like coaches, like life coaches will have the idea that, like, fear's bad, or that you're trying to
100%
get away from these emotions, or like you hit a certain level and then, like, you won't experience anxiety or fear or depression or whatever. Like, you won't have these things anymore once you hit a certain level. And I think they may not even consciously say it, but they kind of like teach that philosophy. And it's
100%.
I think it's an incredibly flawed philosophy, because you can use all these things to your advantage. Yeah. Like you just said a moment ago, you can use those fears to propel you to, you know, put in more work. If you have anxiety about failing a test or not getting a job or not having a girlfriend, yeah. you want to date a girl. It's like, any area of life, you're going to have fear. You're going to have nerves going on stage for a speech. You're going to have nerves before you step on stage.
Oh, yeah.
And those things will propel you to put in the work. First of all, put in the work beforehand to make sure you're prepared and do your best. But then also in the moment, it's good to have that excitement. It's good to have that energy, because that's what's going to propel you in the moment to perform at your best as well.
Exactly. And yeah, man. And to your point, dude, it's not even just the, you know, standard life coaches. I've seen the big names, and I'm not going to name names because I want to talk trash about some specific, but I've seen the biggest names in the personal development industry do things like demonize anxiety, say stuff to people, teach them at their seminars, teach them on video interviews. That's, in my educated opinion and a lot of life experience, highly destructive. Like teaching them, oh, if I got anxiety, here's how to eliminate it. And look, dude, in a big seminar, it's not easy to have somebody go from anxiety to feeling great, you know, smiling with the people in the room crapping. Yeah, no shit. Anybody could do that, you know? My point, like, it's not about that. Like, when I do speeches, I tell people, my goal here is not to motivate you. I don't give a shit if you're walking out of this room with a smile. I know I'm really fun. Kids love me. I'm a really motivational speaker, right? But, like, I tell them, like, my goal is not to motivate you. My goal is to give you tools to navigate pain when you go back into your life, because pain is going to hit. And then what do you do? So to your point, you know, it's not about just like fighting the anxiety. And a lot of people do it. People still say fearless, don't be scared. But the thing is, like, you can't be not scared about something you've never done before. Like, confidence is not the fuel to take action. Confidence is the result, not the fuel. So it's okay to be scared. The fundamental problem is the demonization of fear, the demonization of suffering of any kind. Like, I was at this wellness seminar and somebody asked, like, what's the biggest problem stopping like our collective well-being? And the biggest problem is our negative relationship to suffering. And so the ethos, my fundamental ethos of what I'm doing with Fear of Honest is to help people develop a positive relationship to struggle of any kind, fear, pain, anxiety, stress. When it shows up and you stop saying there's something wrong with it, that's the huge stepping stone. And then, okay, there's something wrong, nothing wrong with it. I can feel it. Now what am I going to do it? And to your point, you prepare. So I always like to say fear propels you to prepare. So if you engage the fear, you prepare. When I wrote my book, I prepared. When I skied across Greenland, I spent a month dragging a 190-pound sled across an ice cap. So I was terrified because that thing could kill you. Like, being out there could kill you in minus 40 degrees, horrible storms. So I prepared. I used to drag tires around my neighborhood for miles on end. You know, so preparing, understanding, studying for people who are more advanced than you, clarity on your path that helps you move through your fear. And perhaps one of the biggest things you can do to move through your fears is to transcend your fears in service of something. Neuroscience has shown that when you think about your goals in the context of serving somebody else, it helps release oxytocin in your brain, which is the quote unquote love hormone. And it doesn't eliminate the fear, but it helps you move through it because you realize it's about something bigger than you, you know? And so using that, visualizing yourself moving through the fear and actually moving through the fear, not just like visualizing yourself on the other end with, you know, the money, the car, the walking on the beach, all that fluffy good stuff, like actually visualizing yourself moving through the struggle itself. These are all very powerful tools to navigate it. But fundamentally, at the very core, it's realizing that they are not the enemy. Don't demonize it when they show up. Don't judge yourself. Don't beat yourself up. Everybody does that, man. They feel fear and then they beat themselves up for feeling fear. There's something wrong with me. Like I worked with one dude who said, I'm just waiting for the fear to go away so I quit my job and start my business, because he thought he shouldn't feel fear. I'm like, that's your problem, bro. Like, you're waiting for the fear to go. You think that's terrifying. Like, don't wait for the fear to go away. Do it anyway, man. Confidence is not the fuel. Confidence is the result.
Oh, shit. Yeah, you're going to be waiting the rest of your life if you're waiting for that to happen.
Exactly.
Even, I'm thinking too, even like depression, like people think depression is like the worst thing ever. And it is hard. It is a bad thing if you don't make any changes. So what depression to me is that it's a signal that there's something off in your life, whether that is nutrition related, whether that's, say, you're missing a key supplement, you know, vitamin or something that you're not getting in your system, your diet's off, whether that's exercise related, whether that is... Yeah. Breakup related, whether that's losing a job, like whether that's you just not being happy with your situation in life right now because for the last few years you haven't done shit and you're just miserable and burnt out, it is a signal for you to make some kind of change. You have to do some, you have to figure out what that is, what you have to do, but you have to start, you know, unlocking those boxes and figuring out which area, maybe it's a couple areas that you need to make key changes in your life. And the people that depression is horrible for over the course of time is the people who never make those changes. They just sit back and, you know, magically expect things to change on their own, and they never do. And that's when depression is a problem. But depression is honestly just a signal that you have to make a change, that there's something off in your life. And most of the time it's something really small, but you got to make that change. And then after that, you're good. So it's actually a good thing if you look at it that way.
I get you, man. I get you completely. Like, and you know, when I've studied depression, I've gone through it in pretty dark ways. When I came back from the war, as I mentioned, PTSD, depression, like, dude, just drinking a bottle a day, man. But, you know, so, but when I studied it myself, a lot of people will say things like, you don't get it. When you're in a state of depression, I can't even move. And like, when I'm in a state, I can't even do anything. And here's the thing about that. I get what there's like, there, people will say things like, depression is not sadness. Depression is a chemical thing in the brain. I get it. But everything is a chemical thing in the brain. Everything is a matter of chemicals in the brain. Joy is a chemical reaction in the brain. So here's the problem is, to your point, 100%, which I agree with, is that we identify with the depression. I am depressed. I have depression. It becomes our self-identity. It becomes who we are. I worked with this one young woman who was labeled with depression by the therapist. The therapist said, you have depression. Highly flawed, in my opinion. And what the problem was, now she would say things like, I am depressed. I have depression. It became who she was. Instead of saying something like, look, my brain goes to a state of depression from time to time, but I am not my brain, and my brain is not me. So to your point, I completely agree. It's a sign. It's a sign that nutrition's off, exercise off, something we need to make changes in our life. One neuroscientist I read said that depression is the lack of novelty, essentially. So creating some novelty, you know, so getting out there and doing something. But people, like, people hold on to it. That's the biggest gap that I see, is that people hold on to it. No, you don't get it. Now, look, you can hold on to it. And God knows I empathize. Like, I've been through it. I work with people, and I've worked with people in some dark places. I've been through the dark places. Like I said, I was on the verge of suicide, man. So, but the problem is, if you are holding on to it, it's not going to, you're not going to help anybody. It's not going to help you. You're going to hold on to it, and you can hold on for as long as you want until you say, you know what? I get it. Everything is a chemical reaction. There is some, no doubt, there's chemical things happening in your brain, but you are not defined by those chemicals. You can, neuroscience of neuroplasticity says we can literally change the physical structure of our brain. We can change it through conscious purpose, conscious intention. I can guarantee you, I don't have the brain scans from when I was drinking to who I am now, but if I had to put $1 million, I put $1 million that my brain is physically different than what it was. You know what I mean? So we can actually change our brain, but we got to stop identifying with it. And if there's like one key line here, one key takeaway is, take this with you, is anybody listening to you, you know, is that you are not your thoughts, your feelings, and your experiences. You are the thinker of your thoughts, the feeler of your feelings, and the experiencer of your experiences. There is a space between what is and who you choose to be outside of what is. So we're going to go through the depression. We're going to go through the lows. We're going to go through the highs, but you're not defined by that. That's not who you are. You can use every experience, every state, every emotion, every thought as a means to move forward in your mission. And that's why it's so important to also have clarity on what that mission is and clarity on that worthy struggle, because then even the darkest of emotions can become your allies. Like, dude, quick note about that. When I struggled with survivor's guilt, I had, after I learned to find beauty in suffering and reframe my own struggles, I for a long time had a picture of my friend up on my wall, the friend I lost in the war, and it said, this should have been you. Earn this life. That's an intense thing to look at every single day, right next to my bed. But that worked for me. Like, guilt became my fuel. Now, only recently did I change it to honor his death, earn this life, because like anything, it can go too far. And I got to a point where I just knew the guilt was getting too much. So I changed it. But things work until they don't. You know what I mean? So you got to find it. Use the demons. Use the darkness, man. The darkness is not your enemy. Go use it. Find ally with your demons. Don't run away from them.
Yeah, I love that, man. And I could so relate to so many of those things. And it really had, like, for me personally, it shaped my entire life. Like, going through the anxiety, the panic attacks, I used to have the depression, like you said, to your point as well. Like, I was suicidal at one point as well for a long time. And it was like, man, it was such a horrible place back then, and going through all that. And even, like, now it feels like I'm a different person. Like, I don't even really remember that, but I can, if I really think about it, I can step into that moment and kind of remember, like, the feelings and stuff I had. But I just remember it being such a terrible, dark place. But I also know now, and I realized like a few years afterwards, like after overcoming it, that it was like my greatest blessing that I've ever had, because it put me on this journey that I'm on now. It's changed my whole philosophy and my take on life. It put me down the self-help path and self, like, furthering myself and all that shit, and then giving back to other people now and helping other people do the same.
Absolutely.
Without that incredible adversity, that struggle I had for so many years, man, I would never be doing the shit that I'm doing today. And like I always say, there's always a blessing in disguise in the things that happen in life. You just got to find out. You know, dig into the weeds and figure out what that thing is that you can pull away from that.
Yeah, 100% agree. And I get that sometimes it's hard when you're right in it. When life has just punched you in the face, it can be a little hard. God knows I get that. Like, but like, I mean, like you said, to your point and to even in my own life experience, every suffering has been, you know, absolute like it's been, you cannot evolve without suffering. So you got to go through the suck to get to the next stage of your awakening, the next growth, you know? So ultimately it's not just whether life punches you. It's, I mean, go out there and seek it, you know? I mean, I always like to say this one thing, like if you don't seek out a worthy struggle, struggle is going to find you anyway. And the difficulty of the worthy struggle is far easier than the struggle of you sitting around doing nothing, waiting for life to punch you in the face. Yeah. So you might as well go out there and fight for what it is you want, because it's going to be hard, but your life's going to punch you anyway. So you get to decide which struggle do you want to endure, man? Which struggle do you want to endure? You're going to endure a struggle one way or the other, but that's not a bad thing. Like, that's a whole ethos of what I do is one of the things I do when I do sometimes speaking, I'll show words like struggle, pain, suffering, fear, stress, anxiety, adversity. How many of you think of these as positive words? And you can do this anywhere, any country in the world. Nobody starts by saying positive. And my whole mission is for people to hear those words and be like, love it. Suffering, bring it, man. Like when I run that 50 miles, I was literally calling forth the devil. I'm running out there to around this cul-de-sac being like, bring on as much pain as you want. Like I want the devil himself to rise out of hell to try and destroy my soul, to try and fucking break me, because he ain't going to touch me and I'm going to bury the devil in his own blood. Like that's how I talk to myself when I'm running. So I get into that space, man. Like bring on the pain. You can't break me. And that's how you grow.
I was actually just about to ask you too. What's going through your mind during that during the running, the races that you have? Is it constant like battling with like the adversary, which is the, you know, the fear and the failure, yeah, and the shit, like all that shit storm? Is it like you just constantly in your head having that dialogue with the enemy that, you know, that's trying to take you down? Or is it,
yeah,
some of that and then like this moments of like bliss and just calm and, you know, happiness? Is it like a mixture, yeah, of those?
Absolutely. Complete mixture. I mean, this is one of the biggest reasons why I love long distance running is it becomes a microcosm for life. So you get to experience the spectrum of the human condition in one little chunk of time, you know? And so, yeah, moments where I'm just in warrior battle mode, other moments where I'm in like pure bliss, other moments where there's no time, you're just lost in the isness of the experience. Other moments where it's like this very spiritual transcendence where I'm like feeling like I'm talking to my own version of what I believe God is, and you know, talking to the divine, being with myself. And so you get to experience all of it. And that's why I love it, man. It's very, very profound. The lows are intensely low and the highs are intensely high, but that's life, man. And so it teaches you how to navigate all that, because it's not just about navigating the lows. Even the highs can consume us. You know what I mean? We get caught up in the highs. What happens? We sometimes get complacent. We stop doing anything, and complacency, as we used to say in Iraq, complacency kills. So the highs can also not always be a good thing. You know, I mean, shit, it's the seeking of high all the time that leads a person to drugs and alcohol, right? So it's not about getting the high all the time. We need to go into the waves of life. The ups and downs are what makes it grand. It's not like a static. There's nothing exciting about a static journey, right? Yeah. So running teaches me all of that.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, this life really is all about balance and figuring out like when you got to push, when you got to work hard, and then when you got to step, yeah, back and also relax and just kind of enjoy things.
Exactly.
What do you recommend, though, for people listening? What's like a good first step for them to take to start doing some of these types of things and challenging themselves and pushing themselves? What are some of the things that you recommend they take up in their lives?
Yeah, there's different avenues you can look at to go, as I like to say, to suffer well. My big mantra is to suffer well. So one of the best things you can do for yourself is exercise. Now, barring any serious physical condition, almost anybody can exercise, right? And exercise is not just the best thing you can do for mind, body, and spirit, even for neurologically your brain. One neuroscientist calls it miracle growth for your brain because of what it does to the synaptic connection. So go out there and suffer, man. And it doesn't have to be running 50 miles. It can be 5 miles, 1 mile. It can be doing burpees, whatever. So that's one way is to you're going to evolve, because exercise teaches you how to suffer. And it puts you in those moments, which you should be going into these moments at least once a week. If not, maybe if you're starting, just do it once a month even, but go into once a week, if not more, once, twice a week, three times a week, where you're going into a moment where one part of you wants to quit and the other wants to fight. Like you're in a self battle. When you experience that moment is a moment of transcendence. So go into those spaces. So exercise is one thing. Another thing is practicing deep stillness. So meditation, you know, going like, you can go to a darkness retreat. You don't have to. I know that's a little bit extreme, but I could not recommend that enough. But being still with yourself. So you can do that multiple ways: meditation, journaling, free flow consciousness. And then like another way that I learned from an endurance cyclist friend of mine, what he would do is he'd sit still staring into a wall for 12 hours. So no TV, no music, no painting, even no stimuli, just staring into a wall for 12 hours and then go running for 12 hours or go cycling for 12 hours because he was a cyclist. So because there's two kinds of meditation. There's one where you let your thoughts flow out of you, and the other one where you actually just don't let your thoughts flow and let them go where they go. So both have their place, both have value. So sitting still. The other one is, I kind of call it the three S's: social, stillness, and suffering. So social is surround yourself by people who are further along the path than you. The path being whatever the path, in exercise, spiritual path, business path, whatever the path is, surround yourself with people who are more advanced than you, because they're gonna shatter paradigms and mental models and belief systems within yourself, and you're gonna realize that I never thought. But you have to be open. You have to be willing to question yourself, question your belief systems, and that's hard to do because people fight, die, and kill for their beliefs. So you have to be willing to say, I could be wrong, and you can hold on to your rightness all you want. Hold on to it. I mean, I guarantee you're not gonna get any further. Like, what got you here is not gonna get you there, wherever there is, right? There could be some things that are working, but some things are obviously not working. So always be looking for two things. All growth is these two things. Find the problem, fix the problem, find what's working, and do more of it. So find what's working, do more of it, and look for problems. Find the problems to fix the problem. So when you surround yourself with people who are more advanced than you, they're going to point out gaps in your way of thinking that will help you create new mental models and create new paradigms that will then help you evolve to that next self, the next version of yourself.
Yeah. So true, man. You are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. It's tried and true, tested. Everyone knows that saying, but I think few people actually live their lives that way, you know, surrounding themselves with those people that are going to lift them up as opposed to just keep them stagnant or even bring them down. Man, it's been an awesome interview, dude. Really do appreciate it. What's the last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave the Elite Man audience, and then a place our listeners can check out your book and your work?
Roger that. Final message is kind of to reiterate this point. I cannot state this enough, is to practice suffering well. Suffer well. Use mantras to guide you. So suffer well is a fundamental mantra that I use. You know, focus on process, not perfection. So when you're in the suffering, when you're focusing on the struggle, focus on the rising above that process, not just about getting on the other end. Be in the process. You know, I talked about finding the problem, fix the problem. Always remember that progress is not the elimination of problems. Progress is the creation of new problems. So whenever you get there, wherever there is, you're going to have some new problems. A billionaire has problems just like somebody with $0 does. They all have problems, just their problems are different. So remember that. Embrace the searching of the problems. Embrace the rising above the problems. Don't look for the end of problems. You do that and you'll fundamentally start to live a more fulfilling life. So get out there, suffer well, and embrace the journey of seeking out one solution at a time. And you can find me at fearvana.com. My social media, Instagram, this, that, and the other thing is Fearvana. YouTube, Instagram, Fearvana. The book is on Amazon, on Kindle, Audible, and paperback, and all the profits go to charity as well. So we support some beautiful causes, like young girls who are victims of sex trafficking, to former child soldiers, and many other causes as well. So that's where you can find me.
Awesome, man. Guys, check them out, fearvana.com. Fearvana is the name of the book as well. Dude, really do appreciate you coming on. This is an awesome interview. I learned a lot myself from this one. So take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, brother.
As a reminder, join our newsletter at elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. There's a lot of crazy things going on, a lot of chaos happening in the world. The one thing I don't want you to miss out on is the incredible information that we provide here at Elite Man Podcast, on the videos, on everything else that we try to give you the best information on. Keep your family safe, keep yourself safe, keep everybody healthy, and don't miss out on any of this information. If somebody just randomly decides to take us down one day, you'll still get it if you're on the newsletter, elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I'd like you to do, and that's this. Subscribe to our podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast episodes and all of our world-class advice absolutely free. Subscribe now if you haven't already and become an Elite Man today. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an amazing review. We really do appreciate it.